Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Into the final hour of the show on a Friday here at CFAX 1070. That means it's time for our regular conversation with one of Canada's foremost constitutional and political experts, UVic Professor Emeritus of Law and Political Science at the University of Victoria. Good morning, Professor Ron Cheffins.
Good morning, Adam. We're going to Quebec today because on Monday they're having a general election. The last general election was October the 1st, where the CAQ won 74 seats, the Liberals 31, and the Solidaire 10, and the PQ 10. I've got in front of me a poll from Angus Reid that I got on Wednesday, so it's right up to date. It shows the CAQ at 34%. That's the governing party, which won the last election, as I say, with 74 seats. 125-seat National Assembly, the Conservatives at 19, the Liberals at 16, Solidaire at 16, and the PQ at 12. Now, 34 is not a particularly high number for them, but Léger, in a poll that came out just a week before last week, showed that the CAQ at 38, the Conservatives at 16, three below what they are with Reid, and the Liberals and Solidaire, exact agreement with Angus Reid, 16, 16, 16, and 16, and the PQ at 13 and the at 12. Okay, now this, the prediction is that the CAQ, which stands for Coalition Avenir Quebec, will win a solid majority, probably anywhere from 90 to 104 seats. Just some background on the CAQ. The CAQ is led by Monsieur François Legault. And François Legault started his political career with the Parti Québécois. Before that, he had been in the airline industry, had built up a small airline, sold it, became a very rich man, so he became independent of a normal livelihood. He quickly left the PQ and formed the CAQ, and the aim of his policy was this: a maximum of Quebec powers and autonomy, but remaining within Canada. And he's pulling that off. Quebec is staying within Canada, but is increasingly autonomous, as reflected in policy over immigration. One of the things he's pushed hardest for is complete control of immigration. At the present time, Quebec controls all economic immigrants, but they do not control refugees or family reunification. And Legault is pushing hard to get those. But he had an amazing rise to power. The party was only ran two elections, got about 20 seats in each, and then won that majority government 4 years ago on October 4th for 74 seats. Now, one of the most interesting, Adam, aspects of this election is the second place by Angus Reid to the Conservatives. The Conservative Party just didn't exist provincially, but along came a very strange character called Éric Duhaime. We don't pronounce the H in French, but it is in the name. Now, Éric Duhaime started very briefly with the PQ, but then he got mixed up with Stockwell Day when Stockwell Day took over the alliance when it merged with the Reform Party. And he is a libertarian, a very passionate libertarian. He wants to increase the speed limit. He's all in favor of private health care. Bill 96, which was passed by the Quebec National Assembly and given royal assent, vastly increased the powers of the French language and diminished the presence of the English language. He would repeal that statute. So he's a man who believes in maximum freedom. And you'll be interested in this, Adam. He began his career as what was called a shock jock with CHOI. You know that station I've talked about?
I am familiar with that, yes.
And well, that's how he began. And for people who don't know it, it was a very irreverent station, politically incorrect, took pot shots at everything that was regarded as sacred and untouchable. So that's how he began his career. And as I say, got mixed up with Stockwell Day and has now revived the Conservative Party. Now, the problem he's got, Adam, is nearly all his vote is in the Quebec City area and in the Beauce, which is just across the St. Lawrence River. And so he could easily get 19%, but come up with virtually no seats. In other words, a lot of good second-place finishes. The Liberal Party is the party that really interests me in this election because it has been the natural governing party of Quebec, particularly since the First World War. Over the conscription crisis, the federal coalition dominated by the Conservatives brought in conscription, and the Liberal Party opposed that, and it has been the dominant party ever since. But their problem now is their leader is Dominique Anglade. Dominique Anglade has an interesting background. Her parents came from Haiti. She was born in Montreal, but her parents came from Haiti, and no one was able to take her on for the leadership. There was a dramatic search for an alternate leader because the feeling in the Liberal Party quite clearly was she was identified off the island of Montreal as an island of Montreal allophone. Allophones are people whose first language is not English or French. Now, her first language was French, but nevertheless, they looked upon her as a tough sell outside the city of Montreal. So the question is, how well is the Liberal Party going to do? It's now very much identified as a Montreal Anglophone West End of the Island of Montreal party. And that party could be reduced to 10 or 12 seats. It's not inconceivable because all of their vote is concentrated among Anglophone ridings on the West End of the Island of Montreal and one across the river in St. Lambert and one opposite the city of Ottawa. So the really interesting issue, I think, is which party is going to form the official opposition. Now, we look at the other two sovereignist parties, parties which believe ultimately the separation of Quebec. PQ started out and won the 76 election and became the first sovereignist government of Quebec. And they proceeded in 1985 to have a referendum on separating from Canada. But the question was laced with references to sovereignty association, a kind of close link between Canada and Quebec. But the PQ and its federal equivalent, the PQ and its federal election equivalent, the BQ, had a referendum in 1995 where the sovereignists only lost by 50,000 votes. But after that, provincially, it's been a downward slide for the PQ, and Solidaire is moving in to replace them. Now, Solidaire is a much more left-wing party. It has co-leadership, a man and a woman, Nadeau Dubois as the man. Now, he became quite famous or infamous is when the Charest government tried to reduce, increase the fees to go to university. Dubois led the charge against it, and finally the government gave up, and the new incoming PQ government finally said, we're not going to raise tuition fees whatsoever. So this is a very left-wing party. Most of its support is concentrated in the east end of Montreal, which is totally francophone, and I see them as becoming the dominant force driving towards sovereignty. But polls, Adam, recently show the support for sovereignty has dramatically declined.
All right.
The most recent polls showed it about 35%. But what Mr. Legault has done and what his policy has been is maximum autonomy for Quebec, enjoying all the advantages of being part of Canada, including the transfer payments, which include particularly the equalization grant. They get $13 billion out of $20 billion. So his policy has been, let's stay within Canada, but let's be maximum in terms of our power within the context of our own National Assembly, so we get the advantages of being part of Canada, and we get the advantages of being almost a separate nation within Canada. So it's having your cake and eating it, if I could put it that way.
I think that's an excellent way to put it. I think it's just about time for our first break, Professor, because we're ending the segment at 11:25 today, so I want to make sure we have lots of time to talk about British Columbia as well.
Oh, you want to do the week? But let's not forget one final thing.
Yes?
Let's not forget Alberta.
We can't forget Alberta either. There's a lot going on as well there.
Well, October the 6th, next week, the Conservative Party picks a leader.
They do, don't they? Danielle Smith, the favored candidate at this time, at least from what I've heard. Want to talk about that after the break as well?
Well, we could, because they're talking now that Liz Truss in Great Britain could be out as Prime Minister of Great Britain before the end of the year because of her tax-cutting policy. So they pick people, the Conservative Party, people with flash instead of people maybe more solid kind of an approach to things. But anyways, I'll talk whatever you want. I was going to do more on Quebec, but...
All right. Well, let's take our break. We'll be back in just a moment here on CFAX 1070. Don't go anywhere.
It's Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
As we continue our conversation with Professor Ron Cheffins. Professor, another 5 minutes left in today's segment. How shall we spend it?
I'm all ready to go with BC if you want some BC stuff.
Whatever's next on the agenda works fine for me.
Okay, I was going to do lots more in Quebec. First of BC is the Liberal Party. Proposal to change the name of the party to BC United. That was the pick at a convention. It's going to be put to a pick of all the members of the party, and they're going to be voting in several weeks from now on picking that name.
Yes.
And it's going to be very interesting if they make that change. I think it's a name change they should adopt.
Mm-hmm.
The best part name would have been the BC Party, but the Elections BC has a list of names that have already been taken, so they had to pick a name that was not on that list, though they couldn't call it the BC Party. The good news for the Liberal Party was they won the Saanich South by-election, a Surrey South by-election, which mm-hmm. was terribly important. In the previous election, they'd got about 47% of the vote. This time, they upped their vote to 52%.
Yes.
30% for the NDP, 12% for the Conservatives, and 3% for the Greens. As I've said to you, Adam, time and time again, that in the election of 2017, Surrey was crucial. There was 9 seats in Surrey. When the government went into that election, that is the Liberal government, they had 9 seats. They came out of that election with only 3. And they got 43 seats, that is to say the Liberal Party, 44 is a majority. If they had retained just one of those 3 seats that they lost, they would have had a majority government. We would not have had a dissolution, and we would have had 3 to 4 years more of Liberal government. And Mr. Horgan, mayor, have never become premier, but everything turned on Surrey. So it was vital for that party to win that by-election, which they won handily with a higher percentage than they had at the general election.
Indeed, I had an opportunity to speak with the newly elected BC Liberal MLA, Eleanor Sturco, from Surrey South, actually on the show last week, as luck would have it.
Well, I saw her on television, very powerful young lady. She was a sergeant in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Yep. Absolutely. And she actually weighed in on the recent report regarding the repeat offender phenomenon that British Columbia has been grappling with. So her knowledge is badly needed, I would suggest.
Well, one final thing, then maybe if one sentence from
sure.
you. I've got a poll on, they ask Canadians right across the country, what's your favorite province other than the one you live in? Number one, British Columbia. So we win and live in the most favorite province in all of Canada. But what do you think of the name change, Adam?
Initially, when it came out, I saw the commentators having quite a bit of fun saying, well, why not BCFC, like as if it's a football club.
Manchester United.
With the BC United, Manchester United. That was what many of the commentators all made that joke almost at immediately the same time as the name was released. I'm ambivalent, to tell you the truth. I've never really found the BC Liberal name itself to be a significant hindrance, and I know that there is a connection with previous missteps that were made by the last government, but there were missteps made by the previous BC New Democrats in the 90s as well. And yet, the BC NDP under John Horgan in 2020 managed to win the largest majority in its history, the NDP's history, I should say, here in BC. So a new name, I suppose, is something that could be a benefit to the party, but I don't know how big of a difference it's going to make either way. That's just one guy's view, though.
Okay, because we're running out of time.
Yeah.
But
keep
in mind, Monday we will discuss next week
okay.
the results of the Quebec election.
All right.
I anticipate the CAQ will win, and we'll mention what happened in Alberta, and we'll see if they actually pick the very erratic Daniel Smith, who wants to pass a statute which allows Alberta to reject any statutes from the federal government. An absolutely unconstitutional and very dim-witted idea.
Perfect. We'll talk about it next week, all right?
Leadership, there's everything on our plate. Okay, bye
for
now.
All right. Professor Ron Cheffins, every Friday as we begin the third hour of the program, UVic Professor Emeritus of Law and Political Science at the University of Victoria. I'm Adam Sterling, back after the news break.
Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
All right, back on the air here at CFAX 1070. Some more time for open lines at 250-386-1161, star 1070, free call on your wireless device. I believe the longest in the queue right now is John. John, you're on the air. How you doing?
Hey there, Adam. I'm doing good. I probably won't be able to listen to this program anymore, but anyways, you with the this Reconciliation Day, I feel very, very, very sorry for the students and stuff for being beaten up and all that stuff. I was too, and I can't explain it. But the one problem I have is they have no proof of the children. They being buried, they have these...
What they have, and I'm glad that you brought this up, John, because I know that some people have brought this up from time to time. What we do have is the findings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 2007, as a matter of fact, already made the finding that there are thousands of Indigenous children buried at various residential schools across Canada. Now, I know what you're thinking. How is it possible that we didn't have the same sort of national outcry in 2007 when these findings were made known by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission? I don't really have a good answer for why it seemed to resonate so much more profoundly when the ground-penetrating radar study was done at the Kamloops Indian Residential School just over a year ago. But there is proof that we do have likely thousands of children that are buried at these residential schools because we have the records. And that's something that we already found as a nation as part of our truth-seeking process well over a decade ago. So I know that some of the folks out there are drawing a distinction between the ground-penetrating radar studies finding disturbances that are likely, or at least potentially, unmarked graves at these schools. It's important to consider that evidence, though, with the additional context that we already were expecting to find thousands of children who simply never came home from these schools because, among other rather grim facts of how the government of Canada managed this practice, was when an Indigenous child would die at a residential school and tuberculosis was rampant during times in the residential school history, as well as other issues that would cause a child to die. The government of Canada did not consider it a justified use of resources to ship the body of an Indigenous child all the way back to that child's community. And that's a grim thing to say. That's a shocking thing to say. And yet it is a true thing to say in many cases. And the family would be notified that the child died, but the resources would not be expended to take the child back home to their community or to arrange for any funerary rites or rituals or services to be held in the community itself. And it's also important to remember that the way that Canada's Indian Residential School Program was built, because it was expected that some of these children would try to escape to go back home, the schools were deliberately, in many cases, located far away from the home so the children wouldn't think that they could just run back home. And that, of course, compounded the transportation costs, which were then, of course, used to justify the practice of not transporting a deceased person back to that person's community. So we have every reason to expect that there are unmarked graves outside these schools. We have every reason to expect that they number in the thousands. We can quibble about ground-penetrating radar studies and exactly how many there might be and what locations they might be in, but it's important that we have that in context with our knowledge that we already had, that they were there and that none of us should be surprised that they are being found. So I do appreciate your concerns, John, and I hope that further information is able to alleviate any others you might have. And it is grim to think about. It's something that our mind, we hear it and we instinctively want to reject it because it's such an awful thing. we don't want to believe that we in our society and that Canada could have ever been part of something like that. And I think that's a very human reaction to think, no, that can't be true. That's just awful. But it is. Is it 215 at Kamloops? Is it a little less? Is it a little more? Does it really matter against the backdrop that there are thousands of children that never came home from these schools, which is the overall point? I think it's very important. So I hope that all of us can reflect on that. But I think an interesting question, a fair question, is that we knew that there were thousands of children who never came home from these schools. We knew that they died because it was so long ago, and we know that they must be somewhere. So why would we be surprised? That's always been my reaction ever since the shocking discovery at Kamloops, and I guess I call it a shocking discovery, suggesting that we shouldn't have expected it. But it's all there in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report. You know, Prime Minister Stephen Harper apologized to Canada's Indigenous peoples when he was still in power because of what was found to have happened during the residential schools program across Canada. You know, these facts are not in contention. They are not in dispute. We just, as a nation, for whatever reasons, were blind to them. It's almost like we saw them, but we didn't see them. Perhaps because they were too painful and too difficult once upon a time. All right. I'm really wincing, Richard. Don't be like that today. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, Adam, don't be so, yeah, whatever. Listen,
no, that's not a good start, Richard.
No, listen.
Fingers over the button. Today, make it good. Yes?
Ben Isaac today, I'm quite in agreement with Ben Isaac's statement, his talk that you were playing there. You know, all he was doing there, from my perspective, was pointing out the importance of democratically elected councils not having undue influence from the unelected bureaucracy. But what scares me about what he was saying, though, is he kept talking about the function of council as being change, 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 change. When I think a lot of us maybe think that certain things in Victoria, whether it was traffic flow or maybe Captain Cook or Johnny McDonald, whatever, maybe, but certain things would have been just fine, sort of kept it status quo. So change in Ben Isaac's mind, to me, is a fairly one-track thing. It means decolonialize, tear down, and with no real thought about how to rebuild or how to improve. His notion of improving is simply to flip everything upside down and eventually make everyone equally poor, filthy, and miserable. And so, but his statement this morning, I agree mm-hmm. with completely that it is important for council. It's even important for an incompetent, terrible mayor and council like we have had. It's still important for them to be not unduly influenced by unelected bureaucracy. So all we can do is hope to elect people that will. Now, the last thing I'll say is that I think what's important that a lot of us, and maybe you can help in this respect, should have a deeper understanding of what the actual, I'll use the words, job description of a mayor and of a council is. Because, in other words, what is the lane that their job description would suggest that they should stay in?
Well, I can start by fixing all the potholes. They're a huge issue.
Yes. Well, exactly. Well, no, that's the one that people use. But listen.
No, it's literal, though. They put so much of the road budget into constructing the bike lanes and that the maintenance wasn't there, the resources weren't there to do maintenance. Staff has already advised council that they're playing catch up on this point. It is literally an issue with filling potholes.
Well, yeah, and I think as a listener, one of the best things that you could do for me, whether mm-hmm. you need to research it or whether you know it, is inform us a little more about what the, for lack of a better term, maybe of what the job description is, what the lane is for mayor and council. My guess is it doesn't talk too much about social policies in China. My guess is that it doesn't talk too much about intervening in wars on the other side of the planet. I'd like to know that I think the highest expectation I could have with an elected mayor and council, whether I like them personally or whether I agree with their personal ideology, the highest expectation that I could have is that they stay in their lane and that they fulfill that duty to their highest expectation. Of course, there's going to be things in that job description that can be interpreted in various ways.
Yes.
But I think if we can return to that lane and hold our mayor and council, you know, to that lane, it would be a good start. So please don't be so paranoid when I call Adam.
I wouldn't say that I'm paranoid, Richard. It's just I want to help you be able to say what I hope you mean to say. That wasn't so bad. All right, we'll take a quick break. Coming up next, more open lines, 250-386-1161. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Texter saying, hi, Adam. Holy moly, Richard was bang on this time. Another texter says, Richard finally has a great call. Wow, clapping. The texter says, I thought he was going to accuse you of fabricating the Truth and Reconciliation findings. I hope that wouldn't happen. But that's the answer, because I know a lot of you talk about the ground-penetrating radar study that happened at the former Kamloops Indian Residential School, the 215 unlikely unmarked graves that have been found. People say, well, hold on, you haven't dug them up yet. Why are you talking about them as if it's for sure? We expected them to be there. That's the missing piece of information that I often find should be added to these conversations. We know, because of the practices of the Government of Canada at the time and the number of children who were taken from communities who died while at the school, and we know that because government practice was that it wasn't willing to spend the money, and this is grim, to transport dead children back to their communities, that the funeral would be held somewhere at the school. Like that just makes sense. So, like, why wouldn't these radar anomalies be unmarked graves now that we're in possession of the facts? And there are grim facts, but we know that children by the thousands over the entirety of the residential schools were taken from their communities and just never brought back. We know that they were marked in one way or another as having been deceased at the school. We know what government practices were, so we would expect them to be buried there. And lo and behold, there are likely thousands and thousands of unmarked graves that continue to be added to this number. It's not disputed or controversial in any significant sense. And I just want to make sure we're all clear about that. Now let's go to Stephen. Stephen, you're on the air. How you doing?
I'm good. I just, my comment, don't get me wrong, but they were all marked graves. Just the wooden cross, they rotten, and our government didn't make an effort to reinstall them again, so that would be marked. But they're not marked today. Name. No, yeah, of course.
I just want to get into a fight about dead kids. Do we really have to debate this?
No, I just don't know. I just don't like when they call them unmarked.
Well, I don't like it that it even matters. Like, can't we just listen?
Sure. Yeah,
that'd be nice, I think. Like, I think that's what today's about. Today's not about a fight. It's not about a debate. It's not about, hey, here's something, let's see if we can knock it down. Today's about, we had a government program where kids were taken from their families, and the kids didn't want to go. The families didn't want to give them up. And it was a fight. In many cases, it was a fight. Kids getting dragged out, kicking and screaming while the parents are kicking and screaming because they know that their kids are either going to come back different, come back told that their language, that their religion is somehow evil, somehow backwards, or their kids aren't going to come back at all. And it was that forced nature of the kids being taken out of the schools that makes those graves so poignant. And I don't think we need to argue, we need to fight, we need to quibble, because there's nothing to win here. There's no points to be gained. It's about recognizing the nature of this program and why, when you know the realities of how the residential schools program worked and what the rules actually were and what the practices actually were, we have every expectation that there are thousands of graves at schools across this country. And like, you can quibble about numbers, but I don't really see why. Anyway, just a thought. When we don't have to talk about this one topic, you can discuss any topic we've discussed on the show lately is open lines. Bruce is up next. Hey, Bruce, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I think the deaths of the children at the residential schools lies at the feet of the Christian Brotherhood and the Catholic Church. they're getting a complete pass on the pedophilia and the abuse that was put on those children directly from the Catholic and the Protestant Church. Those are the people that killed those children. No one's bringing that up. I'm going to tell you something right now. Maybe Sir John McDonald made a mistake on the way he formulated the schools, but those children were handed over to the Catholic and Protestant Church, and they were sexually abused, mutilated, and murdered by the Catholic Church and the Christian Brothers and the nuns of the Protestant Church. There's no doubt about it. Those people ran those churches. They're completely getting a pass. There's something wrong with this. Why aren't the people and the Catholic Church being brought under the table to being paid for abusing and molesting those children and then trying to hide it? Maybe the Canadian government brought those children in, but when the rubber meets the road, the Catholic and Protestant Church molested and killed those children, and that's the truth.
Bruce, thanks for the call. The environment that existed and that was set up with little, if any, accountability, with little, if any, way for a child who was abused to actually tell someone who would help them, had to have facilitated the sorts of actions that you hear the concerns raised about in that call. And again, the system itself is what we are discussing. The system itself and the harms that any reasonable person in possession of the facts should be able to anticipate had to have occurred is the whole point of the day and the whole point of remembering and trying to come to a realization of the harms that were done. When you look at how the system was set up, when you look at how just the credibility of Indigenous peoples in general was regarded during much of Canada's history, and when you look at the credibility of children in general as witnesses and how it would have been treated, it is impossible in my view that the system as it was set up did not allow and facilitate the sort of sick harms that you hear mentioned in that call to at least some degree. And it's important that all of us understand that as well. I don't even know what to say. Today's a day to listen, and I'm still listening. And I think it's important that we listen to the stories that we heard today. Even if you disagree with them, you can still listen to them, and you can still consider them. And the only way that we're ever going to move forward is in possession of the facts. And if you heard something for the first time today, or if you heard something that changed your mind today, then maybe you're a little closer to there, to that space than the rest, than you were yesterday. And hopefully all of us, as we move forward, as we learn more, the path forward will become self-evident. But it's certainly not easy to contemplate these things, nor should it be expected to be easy. Stay safe, everyone. I'm Adam Sterling.